The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha! Guess who? It's me, Brayden. Yes, it's me, Brayden DeVos. My friends and I are taught cooperation in school. Can you, grown-ups, please cooperate? We need to work together for our environment. Mahalo. Take it, solar guy!
Aloha! I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Thursday, March 13th. And I am so excited for today's show, talking about the recent student-led research cruise aboard the Schmidt Ocean Institute state-of-the-art RV Falkor ship. I am also delighted to interview our surprise guest who flew all the way to be here this week for the University of Hawaii Tester Symposium. So without further ado, let's get right to it. First up is Adrian Copeland, a PhD candidate at the University of Hawaii, who studies the foraging behavior of deep-diving whales. She was also recently the chief scientist on the research vessel, Falkor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what an amazing experience and opportunity. How did you get involved with such a cool research project?
Well, it all started out with my committee. My PhD committee decided that I needed more data. And we saw on the SOAS email that there was this great opportunity to do a student-led cruise. The Falkor founders thought it would be great to have students come on board for 3 weeks out of this year. And so we put in a proposal to get a week in February, and we were lucky enough to get granted that week. So we were able to take about 14 students on board this research vessel to do some research.
Now, this is a really unique opportunity. I mean, mostly you have faculty researchers that go out on this cruise, and I mean, this is the first I've ever heard of a student-led cruise before. What was it like to be chief scientist of a huge ship and a big research project?
It was crazy. No, it was a great opportunity. It was really great to learn all the things involved with being a chief scientist. I thought a chief scientist was just doing the day-to-day planning and making sure the marine operations run smoothly. I didn't realize it involved all this outreach and talking to the public and making sure that everyone is aware of what's going on. So it was a great opportunity to kind of learn about the whole process start to finish.
Now, as I understand, SOAS, the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology at the University of Hawaii, they were gifted 100 days at sea. So you got to lead the first expedition, is that correct?
I got to lead the first student cruise.
Okay.
So there's going to be 3 student cruises this year, and ours is the first one, and it appears to be the first one with a student chief scientist. The other 2 cruises are actually going to be led by professors, and they will be more focused towards classroom learning. So those should be really interesting as well. There's also a multitude of cruises this year that encompass some professionals coming out to study like the bathymetry mapping along the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, and they're doing that right now, and they will be out there for a whole month, so that should be interesting as well.
So all kinds of different research happening off this one vessel. Now, what type of research did you partake in?
So we were specifically looking at the ecology of the Kona coast of the island of Hawaii. We wanted to look at the deep sea scattering layer, which is this layer of organisms down about 400 to 800 meters below the ocean. And this deep sea scattering layer appears to be what is attracting deep diving marine mammals to the area. So deep diving odontocetes or toothed whales like sperm whales, short fin pilot whales, and beaked whales dive down to great depths. And we think that maybe there's squid or other fish at these depths that they forage on or they eat.
And so are there other organisms besides squid at that level that they're eating?
So we know that sperm whales mostly, based on stomach contents of stranded whales, we know that sperm whales mostly forage on squid, where short fin pilot whales will actually take fish as well. But again, this is from stomach contents of stranded animals, and so we don't know if this is their real behavior in the wild. This could just be the behavior of individuals that just happened to strand.
This is, what an interesting research project, and something that I don't think too many people have done before. You know, you're looking at a much deeper level than most people. And are you focusing just on the short fin pilot whale and the sperm whale?
So it's part of a collaborative project to look at all the deep diving odontocetes along the coast. I specifically focus on short fin pilot whales and sperm whales. But yeah, many research has tried to correlate marine mammal presence with surface productivity or surface prey, but not that many studies have looked deep into the ocean because it's really hard to sample at these great depths. I mean, we're talking 900 meters below the surface.
And so you're trying to make those links between the top of the water and the deeper water.
Yes.
So what are some examples of odontocetes or whales, as we laymen like to call them? What other species are considered deep diving?
So it's mostly those species in Hawaii. There's also the rhesus dolphin that dives to great depths, but they're not as commonly seen. So we really focus on the sperm whale because it is endangered, and the short fin pilot whales because there is a resident population in off the Big Island of Hawaii.
Now, because you're doing such deep depths, I'm assuming you're not just jumping in the water to deep levels and sitting there on scuba looking at the whales, what they're doing. How do you study these feeding behaviors?
I wish I could jump in the water and dive down to these deep depths. But no, we actually use acoustics or sound. So we take what's kind of like a fish finder, and we input sound into the water and look at the echoes that come back to the surface. And when the sound hits an object, it will return the sound back, and we can get information about layers, or again, the deep sea scattering layer that's about 400 to 800 meters. You can get information about the biomass and what's going on down there.
Okay, so break this down for me. When you say biomass, is that like all the fish in that level, or what is biomass?
So we're mostly looking at smaller organisms, which we consider mictophids. These are organisms about 2 to 20 centimeters, and they're comprised a lot of, micronecton is what we're really looking at, and mictophids make up a large component of the micronecton, about 2 to 20 centimeters. Species we don't usually get in these layers.
Well, that makes much more sense to me. And what about, you say the scattering layer. So is that how far they're spread out, or?
So it's called the scattering layer because it actually scatters sound back. So, yeah.
Very cool. So you're using sound to study something more visually.
Yes.
That's really interesting. And where did you do this work on the cruise? Where did you go?
This work was focused off the western coast of the island of Hawaii. We went mostly around the Kona coast of the island. We were mostly close into shore between Kona and Captain Cook.
Excellent. Those are some nice waters. Did you guys see anything unique or special when you were out there?
Well, it is breeding season in Hawaii for humpbacks, so we did see quite a few amount of humpbacks breaching in the water. We also got to see spotted dolphins jumping, which is really cool to see. So yeah, just a lot of marine mammals out there, a lot of birds. Fun time.
Excellent. And so now that you've collected this information, what happens next? What do you do with all the info?
So next we want to clean the data. So it is acoustic data, so you can get sound from like electronics on the boat, sound from the boat noise. You have to go through and remove all that noise so that way you can just get a clean signal of the actual organisms in the ocean. So we're going to take the data back and clean it, and then we'll actually use some mathematics and some statistics to actually get the biomass in the ocean and see how this biomass changes during whale foraging.
And so this was the main focus of the cruise, but you weren't doing this alone, I hope. You had some help, I'm assuming?
Yes, I did. I was really lucky. There was about 14 of us students and recent graduates that were able to partake in this cruise. We had about 7 marine mammal observers, 4 people that ran the acoustic system that I talked about. We had a couple of people that ran a DITSON, which is an imaging sonar. It, again, uses sound to get pictures of organisms at great depths. And we also had people that went out on the small boat that used a hydrophone, which is a passive listening device, to see if they heard whales clicking in the area. And if you hear whales clicking in the area, then you know they are foraging.
What an empowering experience. And did you find it stressful at all? Or what was the most challenging part of leading an entire team and being responsible for not only the research, but your other coworkers or students that you work with on a day-to-day basis?
I had a great team, so honestly, it wasn't that stressful. The only thing was the lack of sleep. I'm really glad it was only a week because I was working from 7 a.m. till like 10 p.m. at night doing everything and making sure that it all ran smoothly. So that was the main thing. But overall, it was a great experience, and I had a great team of students to help.
And have you been on other research vessels before, or was this your first time?
No, this is my 7th cruise. I've been on anything from a small Boston Whaler up to the Falkor, which is about 290 feet. So it's really interesting to see the difference between all these different vessels.
And how did that feel, that position change from, you know, leading a cruise to just participating on one?
It was good.
Yeah.
It was like I said, it was interesting to learn all the responsibilities required. And yeah, it was just a great overall experience to kind of have your hands in everything. And so that way you always know what was going on. And it was just interesting to see all the research at work.
So what's the next steps for you for your research? Do you have more field work coming up, or are you going to start to analyze those results?
Yes. So we actually use Monday for another cruise.
You don't waste any time, do you?
No. But yeah, we leave Monday on another cruise. We're going to do similar work, but this time we'll have an ROV, or Remote Autonomous Underwater Vehicle. And this will be actually putting down, hopefully, in these deep sea scattering layers to see kind of what's going on down there, what organisms are down there. That should be really interesting and fun.
And you presented a little bit on the work that you have done so far today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I presented on some of the work that had been collected on a NOAA research vessel on the Oscar Alson study. And it's similar to the work that we did on the Falkor, and it's just looking at the distribution of the organisms in the deep and seeing how that distribution changes during whale foraging. And I saw with sperm whales that there was significantly lower biomass or amount of organisms in the ocean during foraging, which was interesting, which we didn't expect. We thought there would be significantly higher biomass.
Interesting. And so this presentation you gave today was at the Tester Symposium, which is an annual event, and it's a student-led conference. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the Tester is a more Memorial Symposium that's put on every year. This year was the 39th annual symposium, and it is led by graduate students. And so each year they have presentations from graduate students in all disciplines, ranging from zoology to biology to marine biology to geography. We had someone from sociology come today. So it's just a wide range of disciplines that come and give presentations, and then the people that they pick the best three presentations, and of those people, they plan the next year. So it's been interesting.
Well, you did a fantastic job, so I hope maybe that will be you next year.
Well, thank you.
And from a student-led cruise to a student-focused conference, it's really important and nice to see all this effort going into a lot of the research that's happening with UH graduate students. What are you going to take from all these experiences when you graduate and leave your current status as a student?
I think it's been a great experience to teach me how to be organized and how to plan. You definitely want a detailed plan with anything you do. It makes things a lot easier if you plan ahead. But I think the main thing to take away is just because even though we're just students, we're still able to provide a lot for whether it's a conference or whether it's this research opportunity. So I definitely want to stress to any graduate student, if you see something out there you want to do, definitely submit a proposal or definitely try to do it, because you never know unless you try.
That's really good advice, Adrienne. Thank you so much for being here with us today. I can't wait to hear more about your work. We're actually going to take a quick traffic break, and I know I've promised a surprise guest today, and she will be coming up. But first, we'll be talking with another graduate student aboard the ship, Jessica Tim.
760 KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Accidents right now, Salt Lake. Salt Lake Boulevard at Maluna Street. Another one on the H1 Airport Viaduct. This is Evabound at the Hickam Curve. And in Kailua, we had an accident at Hamakua Drive and Kailua Road, and that's slowing down that northbound traffic on Hamakua. Otherwise, traffic typical to the windward side. If you're going west, the H1 is stop and go from the Airport Viaduct to the Radford Drive overpass. That's because of that accident.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha, this is your solar guy, Jeff Davis here. If you have any questions regarding HECO's new regulations for photovoltaics or solar electric in your neighborhood, as you know, they have new rules, just call me at 554-7200. I'll answer your questions most likely right over the phone, 554-7200. And please don't forget, solar hot water, solar-powered pool pumps, solar heating, all that is good to go. I can handle any of those questions as well. Call your solar guy at 554-7200. Aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
Aloha! It's me, Brayden DeVos. And again, I ask a favor. Will you help restock the fish on our reefs so when my friends and I go snorkeling, we can see Hawaii as it should be? Mahalo. Thank you, Solar Guy.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And today we are fortunate enough to have some of the talented students that just participated on the Schmidt Ocean Institute's RV Falkor ship. Joining us now is Jessica Chen, a PhD student at the University of Hawaii, studying with Dr. Whitlow Au in the Marine Mammal Research Program. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jessica, what was your role on the student expedition?
My job was Marine Mammal Observations Lead. So my job was to coordinate all the Marine Mammal Observers, making sure everyone was trained. And then also we ended up going out on the small boat every day trying to listen for the whales and dolphins to help find them for Adrian.
Excellent. So how does one go about listening for the dolphins or finding them?
So we went out on the small boat every day taking a hydrophone with us, which is like an underwater microphone. We were able to listen going through our equipment to all the sounds that were in the ocean. The reason we took the small boat out was because the large boat generated so much noise that we couldn't hear anything. We couldn't drop the hydrophone deep enough to get away from the noise. So we went out, dropped the hydrophone far enough away to avoid the ship noise, and tried to listen for any clicking, which would signal foraging by these animals.
So now I know on other ships that are larger research ships, they have little smaller boats that they drop off the side and go off. How did you get from this big ship to these little ships?
They had a similar setup. They had a small boat that could be craned over the side, and then they would drive up next to the ship, and then we would get off on a step ladder to climb into the boat and take off. And then same thing when we came back, we would have to climb up this ladder while the small boat was pushed up against the larger ship before they picked up the small boat again.
Was that an exhilarating experience for you?
It was pretty exciting sometimes, but we had good calm weather, so it was not too dangerous.
Excellent. Safety first, absolutely. Yeah. And so you said you were in charge of training the observers. How does one learn to become an observer?
Well, first you have to be willing to be very patient. You stand up there and look at the ocean for hours at a time when you may not see anything. And then there's just learning how to ID the animals, and that really takes a lot of experience. So I can go through how to identify animals, what are some of the characteristics, how to use the equipment, and what notes to take. But really, the best learning, best way of learning is to go out there and experience it and practice.
So what kind of observation techniques do you use? Or, I mean, I know with the humpback whales, you look at the tails for identification marks. What kind of things were you training these observers?
We were just looking for marine mammals. So firstly, everyone had to use binoculars and their own eyes just to look. We were searching around the ship 360 degrees all the time during daylight hours. So I had them just looking for anything, splashes that looked unusual, that didn't fit with the way the waves were moving, blows from larger whales, so clouds of mist that you could see above the water. And then sometimes you could look near boats to see, because fishing boats often like to be near dolphins because they think they'll be near fish. And so that is one cue that they can look for to help spot animals. But pretty much they have to be up there searching all the time, looking out there.
That's got to be so exciting, though, when you do see something or you're the first one to spot a marine mammal. Like, is it, does everybody break out into cheer? Do you get excited? Or how does that feel?
People do get very excited, especially since Hawaii has fewer animals than a lot of other areas. It's kind of in a poor area of the ocean. So when people spot an animal, goes out over the radio, we spotted an animal, and we try and keep track of it. We don't want to lose it once we actually spot it.
Excellent. And that, you said, goes on 24 hours a day, so you were on rotating shifts, or?
Well, we had rotating shifts, but it was only during daylight hours, because you can't really see anything at night, especially when you're trying to spot animals. They're often several miles away, especially the larger ones.
So besides your eyes and binoculars, are there any other types of equipment you use to observe the marine mammals?
Well, for observations, those are the most important, but we did try and do some photo identification. So we had cameras with long lenses so that we could try and get good pictures. For whales, you know, a lot of them are identified using their flukes, their tail flukes. And but for the smaller dolphins, such as the pilot whales, which we were looking for, they're identified using their dorsal fins. And also just looking at the animals when we're trying to take notes on where we find them, we do take GPS positions on the ship and try and calculate distance using basically a clinometer, I guess, in the binoculars, getting an idea of how far it is, as well as angle to the ship. We had angle boards made up so we could get a good idea of which direction the animals were in, so we could inform the bridge and they would know which direction to look and make sure they knew where the animals were so they wouldn't try and run over them.
Well, that is a very good safety precaution, definitely. Now, I heard a rumor that you guys tested a blimp to look for marine mammals. Is that correct?
Kind of and kind of not. So the RV Falkor crew had ordered a blimp, which they wanted to try using for scientific work. And this hasn't really been done before. People are starting to use drones now for survey work. They wanted to try and use a blimp to look for animals. But since a blimp had never been launched off a moving ship before, that was kind of the first test, and they did do that successfully. Perhaps for future work, they'll be able to actually go look for animals with it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And did you see anything surprising when you were out there, something that you'd never seen before?
I wouldn't say surprising so much, but I had never been that close to a pod of pilot whales before, and that was very exciting to be able to go in there, get close, and to do the photo identification work and to observe their behavior.
Did you get to smell them?
I don't think I smelled the pilot whales. Their blows are a little bit small, and we didn't get that close.
Okay. Well, I know it's a weird question, but sometimes when you're out there, you know, you can smell the animals. And,
yep. You can smell it when you're close to a humpback whale. That's much bigger.
And so was this your first experience at sea, or how did it compare to if you had been out to sea before?
This was not my first cruise. I've been out to sea before, mostly on small boats, but this is my third cruise on a large ship, and I have to say the Falkor is a very nice ship, and the other ships I've worked on are also good, but I have to say Falkor kind of stands out.
Excellent. Well, is there anything you took home from this cruise that you would want to share or pass on to other students? Anything that you learned that was new, not necessarily about the research, but just being out on the water and working with fellow colleagues?
Yeah, I would say this was a really unique experience, partly because it was a completely student-run cruise. Adrian was chief scientist, and then I had the job of marine mammal observation lead. I was kind of unsure at the beginning if I would be able to do this, but I'm really excited that I accepted and went out and took on the challenge, and I think I did okay.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Jessica. I really, really appreciate it, and I can't wait to hear more about the student-led cruise. But now the moment we have been waiting for, from students just starting their career to a surprise guest who is one of the most established and distinguished marine activists and inspirational women I have ever met. To give you a hint, this person was named Time Magazine's first hero for the planet and was one of the first and only people to walk the ocean floor at great depths with any tether. If you still have no idea who I'm talking about, or if you've been living under a rock for the last couple years, I am overjoyed to bring you her deepness, Dr. Sylvia Earle. Dr. Earle is the founder of the Sylvia Earle Alliance and Mission Blue. She is the National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and in general, an amazing advocate for the ocean. It's my pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm just starting my career, too.
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to the ocean, we're always learning. So,
yeah, lots to do.
What brings you to Hawaii?
Well, I'm here for the symposium, the Altester symposium. Which one is this now? It's been going on for some years.
Would you say 39.
Yeah.
And this is not your first trip to Hawaii. You're no stranger to the islands. You have been here diving for many years. Are you still diving?
I was last week.
Excellent.
I breathe, so I dive.
So for someone who has experienced so much, and you know, you've seen it all, you've been on all these dives, I'm sure. Is there new experiences for you? How does it feel when you still get in the water and dive?
Well, most of the ocean hasn't been seen at all. Like 95% is unexplored. We have better maps of the moon and Mars and Jupiter than we do of most of this planet, the part that's underwater. And that's just the maps. But the water column above is the ocean, of course, and we're still having a hard time getting a mere 7 miles down, or all that space in between. The University of Hawaii, of course, has two really cool submersibles, the Pisces subs. Unfortunately, they're on hard times now for funding, but they are true jewels. I had the pleasure in the December of 2012 of coming out here and diving in one of the subs. Well, both subs were out there looking at some of the deep coral reefs. In fact, we were originally scheduled to go out to where I made a dive in a gym suit going back to 1979 to compare the areas then and now. We got skunked by the weather, but we did get to see some really great places, corals and relics from World War II that are still out there. Picked up a cup.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
And, you know, you mentioned being able to use technology and use these changing tools for exploration underwater and to achieve new depths. Do you think that this change has influenced the future direction of research, or where do you see it going from here?
Onward and downward, I hope. It's the obvious thing to do. I mean, what's happened in the last 50 years or so, we've really learned more about the ocean than during all preceding history. And it's because of the technology that exists that gives us the capacity to go high in the sky, to view from above and at least map the surface, and even to map under the surface using satellites, taking advantage of the slight differences in sea surface, the level of the sea, that reflects something about the terrain below. Not in great detail, but we have made discoveries from high in the sky of what's in the depths below that, again, things that we did not know about before the present time. Even the existence of life in the deepest sea, it took really until well into the 20th century before we had the capacity to do that. It was 1960 when the first descent to the deepest part of the ocean took place. And then until 2012, no one actually returned, at least in a round trip, because easy to go one way, but those don't count. And then, of course, with the Falkor, you're just describing how it's possible now to have instruments that can be lowered from the surface in ways that really are unprecedented. The use of sonar. Technologies developed during wartime being applied for peacetime exploration. And also, sadly, being used to exploit the ocean in ways that also are unprecedented. We've seen since the middle of the 20th century the consumption, the taking of wild fish, sharks, tunas, swordfish, many kinds of creatures that are historically at historic low levels, I mean 90%, some of them even more than 90%, gone because of our capacity to find them, extract them, and market them in ways that no generation before the present could possibly imagine. So it cuts both ways, this technology. I mean, I embrace it fully. I think the key is using the technologies that we have to understand the world and understand what we're doing to it and why it matters.
And that's so important, using that technology for science and applying that science to make management and conservation more applicable. In your career, you've been able to do so much on both ends, and to me that's very amazing, because usually people are career scientists or career managers, and there's not always that overlap, and you've been able to cover both of that. Was it hard making transitions, or how did you apply the science to the management, or vice versa?
Well, I don't have a recipe for how you do whatever it is, but what baffles me is that people say they're bored. But what can I do? I just can't think of anything to do when there's so much to do on so many fronts. And the fact that we are blessed, especially in the United States at this point in history, when we have choices, when we have freedom to do things. Everyone has constraints. You're too tall, you're too short, you're a girl, you're a boy, or you're this color or that, but mainly, get over it. You know, you're alive, whoever you are, and you're not in jail. Or if you're in jail, you probably have some choices too, but the fact that you're breathing, and you look around at all the incredible things that are available to anyone. As a scientist, I consider myself first and foremost a scientist. What's a scientist? Somebody who observes carefully and then reports honestly what you observe to the best of your ability. Now, it helps to go through the process of learning how to analyze and how to report honestly. And during this conference, I've seen some great examples among the students. We're doing just that, observing carefully and with some amazing new methods of reporting and measuring and otherwise getting information to get it out there. And really impressive, much better than when I was at the same stage of trying to become a scientist. And partly it's the technology, but I guess, you know, this university rocks. got a lot of diversity about it that is part of the education in itself.
Well, I might be biased, but I also think it's a great program. You obviously had to overcome things to get to where you are today. What have you found to be your biggest challenge in science?
I'm small. I have to stand on a chair sometimes to get to where I want to go. It's an advantage getting into a submarine. I stand in a crowd and I can't see over anybody else. Anyway, how do you overcome? It's whatever. I don't have a straight answer for that, except to say that if you really care about something, you can find lots of reasons why you can't get from here to there. Oh, my grant didn't come through, or oh, it's that person with whom I wanted to work has declined the honor, or the creatures that I was hoping to work with, they aren't behaving properly, whatever it is. You can find excuses, but don't give up. Figure out a way. I mean, I wanted to get submarines, and it's hard to get time on Alvin, for example, using the traditional methods. And I guess it was frustration that led me to start a company. I mean, I'm a botanist. I'm not an engineer, and I'm not a jillionaire. But by figuring out how do we get you know what your goal is. I want a submarine. So you start a company that has to be profitable. I mean, that's the nature of a business. You have to make more money than you spend. It's the way you have to live your life, generally speaking, or you don't succeed. But to start a company that also makes a difference. So I've started three companies. So in addition to trying to be a good scientist, to try to figure out how you harness free enterprise, which is a wonderful freedom that we have in this country, and use it as an alternative means to get from here to there. And my objective wasn't to make a ton of money. It was to make a difference by developing new technologies that could be used in ways that to explore the ocean. Well, my daughter and son-in-law now own and operate the most recent of the three companies, Deep Ocean Exploration and Research. And it's really exciting to see them, you know, take on this challenge. And the most recent success they had, I think, was delivering to the University of Hawaii a 6,000-meter remotely operated vehicle that has just been tested. Oh, and it works. Huh. So cool.
It's always a good sign when it does work.
It's like an avatar of those on the surface. You know, you have your remote presence is operating far from where you can go. Now, I love both approaches, sending remote technologies as well as the personal presence. I don't think one is a substitute for the other. You need both.
And as a role model for so many with that can-do attitude and still doing what you do and doing it amazingly, what advice do you have for the students at the Tester Symposium and for the students that just came off the cruise that are just embarking on their future research?
Yeah, well, find something that you love so much that it doesn't feel as though it's a job. You know, I get so many questions about, well, you know, what can I do? I think I can make a living as a marine biologist. Sure looks like fun, but I think I better try something else. Well, I think you should do that which strums your heartstrings the most, because if it is what you love, you'll be good at it. And whether it's in law or music or teaching or running races or, I don't know, whatever it is, making cigars, if it's what you love to do, your chances are you'll be good at it, and chances are you'll make a living at it.
Couldn't agree more. Dr. Earle, it is an absolute honor to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for carving some time, I know, in your very busy schedule in the few days you have here. Dr. Earle will be presenting the closing address tomorrow at the Albert Tester Memorial Symposium, at the East-West Center. We'll take a quick traffic break.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
One new accident up in Wahiawa, Kamehameha Highway at Olive Avenue. Got an accident in the Salt Lake area. It involved a pedestrian, and police have closed Salt Lake Boulevard eastbound at Pakini Street for an investigation. The accident happened at Maluna Street. If you're going west on the freeways, the H1 slows at the airport exit on the viaduct. The Moanalua Freeway slows at the Fort Shafter overpass.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kaho'olawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opilioahu.com.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's two decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
My name is Braden DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. And in terms of getting an education, we certainly did. Just heard from Her Deepness, Dr. Sylvia Earle, with words of wisdom for our students who just participated in a student-led cruise. With us now is Ali Bayless, who was also on the Falkor. Ali completed a Master's of Science in Zoology from the University of Hawaii in 2012 and currently works as a bioacoustician for the Joint Institute of Marine Biology and recently participated as the outreach coordinator on the Falkor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks for having me.
So, Ali, you were the outreach coordinator on the cruise. We've heard from Jessica and Adrian, who talked a lot about the science. What was your role?
Well, so I worked alongside my colleague, Billy Lee, who actually has a background in visual arts and filmmaking, which I do not. And so together, we coordinated interviews with scientists while out at sea. We also filmed all the research activities that were going on. And we edited 7 different video blogs while on the cruise out at sea. And then we also had all of the people in the Science Party participate in a written blog that was posted on the SOI website. And so everybody kind of took a turn on writing about their experiences.
What was the most challenging thing about recording all of that information while out at sea?
Well, it was really challenging for me because I was also trying to assist with the research. So anytime I had a break, I was just, you know, running to my computer and editing as quickly as possible. We really had to manage our time well. So, you know, we basically had to film, edit, and then email the video by the end of the day. And so that was really complicated.
Quick turnaround.
Yes, it was.
So what kind of things were you trying to capture?
Well, so because this was a student cruise, we really tried to focus on what the students were learning. We had a lot of students that had never been out to sea and had never been on a large vessel before. So we really tried to capture what that experience is like for someone that hasn't done it before. We did special videos on the active acoustics that Adrian was leading. We also had another segment where we actually went out on the small boat with a video camera and filmed Jessica using the hydrophone to listen for foraging whales. And we also did a special video on the blimp, which was very interesting. Basically just trying to capture what the students were learning while they were out there.
And were you able to connect with any of the people reading your blog?
Yeah, actually, we had 17 different schools following our blog, which was really cool. There were middle schoolers and high schoolers that had subscribed to the blog, and we reached almost 700 students that way, which was pretty incredible, from 5 different islands. So there were a lot of people checking the blog daily. We also had people from NOAA scientists, and people from the University of Hawaii, as well as other nonprofit organizations that were emailing me and saying how great the blog was and the videos, that they really enjoyed learning about what we were doing.
That's an amazing reach. Congratulations on that number.
Yeah, thank you. We were happy with it.
So, you know, when trying to communicate, you know, this experience to students, I think it's kind of nice having students talking to students. What were some of the questions that you get from students, or things that people wonder that don't go on these cruises or don't know a lot about marine science? What do you think they wonder about?
Well, that was actually a challenge for me because I'm a scientist at heart, and so I really had to take a step back and think about, you know, what does the general public know and what would they be interested in learning? So it was nice interviewing students that had never been out to sea before because they had a really fresh perspective, and everything they were learning was probably for the first time. So when we were writing the blogs and doing the videos, we really tried to gear it towards, you know, just your average person that has never been out to sea, and, you know, what kind of science is going on and why it's important for different marine conservation issues. And we really tried to communicate that.
Was there any common theme amongst the students who was their first time out at sea that, you know, did they get seasick, or were they just in awe of all the equipment? Or
I think they were really in awe. As we talked about earlier, the Falkor is an amazing ship. It has really, really incredible capabilities with its sonar system and its active acoustics, and everything just went really smoothly. So I think they were kind of surprised by that. They also were surprised by how much work it was because, you know, when you're out at sea and you're out in the sun all day, there are long hours, and, you know, it's not a pleasure cruise. So I think a lot of students were surprised at how much work it was.
I've been on a couple of research cruises before, and it's the best sleep I ever get, you know, between being exhausted from working all day and the gentle roll of the ship.
Oh, yeah.
You sleep like a baby. So how are you using the films besides the blog to engage the public?
So we've actually Adrian went out on Hawaii News Now. Some of the footage from the video blogs was put out on, you know, our local TV station, which was really cool. And then we've had so many people checking the Schmidt Ocean Institute website to read the blogs and check out the videos that we've just reached so many people that way.
And how is this work different from what you normally do?
Oh, it was really different because, like I said, I'm a scientist, and I'm so used to being focused on my research that it was really nice to get to be artistic and creative and really take a look at what we do, what the students were doing, and really how cool it is, you know? That's what we wanted to show everybody, is that the research we're doing is pretty groundbreaking, and it was really nice to capture that on video, because that's a really great way to engage the public. It's just a fun way. If you see a video and you actually see what people are doing out in the field, it's exciting stuff.
And so the schools that were following the blog, as I understand, there's going to be some visits, some follow-up visits with them?
Yeah, actually, Adrian and a couple other of the students will be doing three class visits in the next couple months. I know that two of them will be here on Oahu, and then another one via a Skype phone call, I believe, on Lanai.
Amazing. Yeah. So it sounds like it was a pretty positive experience for you.
It was, and I really enjoyed the blend of using my artistic side and my the side that's the scientist, and being able to create something that was unique and special.
And how was it working with other students, being a recent graduate, when you're looking at the other students doing their research? Can you emphasize, after just recently graduating and now being in the work field, all the data that needs to be collected and what they need to do?
Yeah, it was actually a lot of fun, I'll say that, because students, being that it was all students on the cruise, I think the crew of the ship, of the Falkor, was actually really surprised as well that we were all really hard workers, but, you know, also were able to have fun while we were out there. So that was a really unique thing, I think, about this cruise, being that it was student-led. And I also talked with a lot of people about their thesis work and, you know, gave some advice. And I think that they're all doing really great work, so it's exciting.
You know, you always learn something new, no matter if you're a student or a senior scientist. As Dr. Earle mentioned, you know, there's always something to see, something new to discover in the ocean. I'm going to put this question out to all three of my student guests today, Adrian and Jessica and Allie. What new thing did you learn participating on this cruise?
Well, for me, it was really just learning how to use multimedia to reach, basically to communicate science. Because I think as scientists, we get so focused on our research and getting results and publishing that we forget that there's a lot of people that are interested in what we're doing. And so to be able to communicate what we were doing, I think that's the greatest thing that I took home from this cruise.
Yeah, I think I'm going to echo that. I think it was great to learn how to write a blog and do a video where the public can understand and the public can really appreciate what you're talking about. Scientists, we like to use scientific jargon and use Latin names and everything, and but really you want to be able to explain to the public why it's important to study what you're studying.
Yeah, I think I'd have to say the same thing. I hadn't really thought much about the, you know, outreach part of research as much, because I was so focused on getting my own work done. So it was really great to be able to participate, help take pictures and put them out, and also just seeing all the organization that's needed to go into such a project, and it was just really great.
Well, I am so happy that you three could come on the show today and share a little bit about your wonderful experiences. I want to take a moment to thank all of our guests who could join us today. For more information to listen to our podcast, please be sure to check out www.cosi-ie.net. I'd like to give a special thank you to Jeff Davis, Kosi Island Earth, and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy the ocean planet.
Best embryo. We chose to have the embryoscope because it's a state-of-the-art technology that gives them the best chance of getting pregnant.
For more, contact the Pacific In Vitro Fertilization Institute.
Since the beginning of the year.
New numbers and horror stories as crooks.